So, oh yeah, the title of the talk was really, or the thing about me being a recovering fundamentalist Christian, it's really was meant to be provocative and maybe bring some people in. So, I don't know. Did anyone come based on reading that line? Just curious. No one? Okay. Well, anyway. Okay. It's all right, anyway. Thanks. So, that's going to be part of what I'm going to talk about. Even just this weekend, I went to visit my aunt and uncle in Southern California, and they were missionaries in Africa and Japan in the 40s and 50s, and are still as devout Christians as ever in their late 80s now. And they told me that they're still praying for me, pray for me all the time. And most of my family is still praying for me. So, anyway, so this talk is a way to try to explain why I love the Dharma so much, and why I'm so grateful for it. And I'm kind of going to focus on one point, which is really, really critical, I think, to why the Dharma is so valuable to me. But it's also kind of a hard thing to articulate, and that's this idea about the emptiness of thoughts. So we'll see how it goes. But you can feel free to ask me questions at the end. I guess a little more introduction. My name's Eric again. I'm doing the chaplaincy training program with Surja here as well. That's run by the Sati Center and held here at IMC. And as my volunteer position for that job, I'm in the HIV/AIDS ward, leading a meditation group there. And as my paid work, I'm working in a crisis residential home for the mentally ill, as well as a homeless shelter for the mentally ill. Very challenging work, and the Dharma is really critical in staying stable in the midst of that, the sort of chaos that I put myself in every day. I'm going to call this talk "How the Dharma Saved My Life." To be provocative again, I guess. Okay, so this one night, my first year in college, I was up late working on a paper and lay down on the couch just to take a little bit of rest. And all of a sudden, I had this this waking vision, basically, of these giant pillars that were like holding up the sky, basically. And these like huge Corinthian pillars, and they started crashing down. Kind of like when Solomon, you know, pushed the pillars of the temple and they all started crashing down around him. And then I started to fall, basically, through the floor and through space. Just falling and falling past stars, past planets, just through the void, the emptiness of space. And it was terrifying. I started kind of hyperventilating. My heart rate shot up, and I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I think in retrospect it was probably clinically like a panic attack. And I went up to my mom's room and told her what had happened and asked if I could sleep next to her bed that night. And you know, this is when I was 19, so I was pretty scared to have to sleep next to my mom. And for several years after that, I would periodically have the same nightmare that I was just falling through the dark, vast emptiness of space alone, with no hope of ever landing anywhere. Basically, there was this idea of the sort of, just that it was going to be endless falling. So I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things in my life that led up to that kind of feeling, and then how the Dharma helped me out of it. So I grew up in Orange County in Southern California in an upper middle class home. My dad was a successful salesman. My mom was the dutiful housewife, and but a great mom, and she still is. My dad, taught me how to surf and fish and hike and camp and all these cool things. And my mom was always there at home, waiting for me when I came back from school, always supportive, still very supportive. And I had a church youth group that I was really active in that gave me a lot of stability in my life as well. So all sorts of things really, including just the basic sanitariness of the suburban world, helped me feel pretty safe. I didn't know what I was in for, because things started getting a little tricky. At 16, my appendix burst, and I didn't know that it had burst. There was a really bad flu going around that they misdiagnosed, and they just said that I had this bad flu. So I was at home for almost 3 weeks, puking up bile and stuff because I couldn't hold food down anymore. I hadn't been able to hold food down for like a week and a half at that point. Still puking up and lose weight. And just prior to getting sick, I had been in water polo, and I was at the end of Hell Week in water polo training, and was just like in peak physical condition, and feeling like, on top of the world sort of thing. So I basically almost died, and I spent a few weeks in the hospital while they took care of me. But I was really, during that period, I was really forced to pay attention to my body. This was before I got into the hospital and they started me on morphine, which I very much enjoyed. But before I started on the morphine, I really had to pay attention to my body because the suffering was so acute, not pay attention to it. And it was the sort of meditative kind of relationship with my body, in that I wasn't detached from it, but I wasn't overly disturbed by it, because I couldn't be really, because it was so constant and present. In order to get through the experience, I had to come to some sort of equilibrium with it. That's something I'm still learning in my meditation practice. But anyway, I went back to school, and since I had had this kind of near-death experience, I wasn't relating to life the same way as my peers were anymore. I wasn't taking sports as seriously. I was searching for something deeper. And I was searching for a way to serve others, to be with others in their suffering, since I had gone there. But relative to this talk, the point I'm trying to make is that there was a sort of identity shift going on for me, where I wasn't the young, athlete, secure in the suburban world anymore. I had this entryway into the world of suffering, which connected me with the rest of the world, and the suffering going on in the rest of the world were opened. And I couldn't close them again and pretend like all the perfect stuff around me was all that there was to life. Around the same time, my mom started dealing with some childhood trauma and reevaluating the whole way our family worked, and going to codependency groups and stuff like that. And in her CODA group, when she came back with was, and my mom and I used to talk actually a lot during this period. She talked about how a lot of, or codependent relationships are based on fear. And that really hit me a lot because my relationship with my dad was based on fear. My relationship was based on fear. And I realized that my relationship with God was also based on fear. So that piece. And yeah. Yeah, hopefully I'll get to that, and if I don't, ask me the question again at the end of the talk. So then, the last piece, my junior year, I got this controversial history teacher who was known for really bashing the Christian right, and like everyone in Orange County is kind of the Christian right in some way. A lot of people are. So he was sort of attacked status quo and was not very popular for it. And people were always having these, you know, PTA meetings were always discussing whether fired. So I knew this going into it. And I was a kind of, well, after I did a missionary trip to Europe just prior to my appendix bursting. And then with my appendix bursting, I was sort of renewed in my faith for God. And so going into this history class, I was ready to take this guy on. And I was ready to, you know, I was going to debate. I was going to prove him wrong. And but some of the things he said started to sort of work at me. One of the things he talked about was, you know, the Puritans and the witch burning people alive for their different beliefs. This idea the Puritans had that the rich were favored by God. And then he just talked about in general, like the militaristic, homophobic, anti-environmental, anti-poor, anti-working class sort of values of the Christian right. And it struck me more and more as being really un-Christ-like. So I started to ask a lot of questions. And I guess that's where actually the fear piece comes in, is I think that's what allowed me to start asking the questions, because before I didn't want to ask questions, because if I did, it could disrupt my relationship with God and I could end up leaving the church or something and going to hell. There was always this fear of hell somewhere in the background. Yeah. So, you know, I really did decide that I wanted my relationship with God to be based on love. So, yeah, anyway, after about 3 years of living in this kind of, you know, intensifying internal and external chaos, I had that panic attack I described, and then I started to think about suicide and, you know, really wanted life to make sense again. So this is sort of where the Dharma comes in. At San Francisco State, I enrolled in a class called Humanism and Mysticism, and as an assignment for that class, I, like the bio said, I spent a week at the San Francisco Zen Center, and one of the first meditation instructions that I remember receiving was that you picture your thoughts like clouds passing through a blue sky. So I was doing that, you know, seeing these thoughts kind of pass through like kind of wispy, ephemeral things through the sky. And then the thought, Jesus is Lord and Savior, went through the sky. And I thought, well, Jesus, if my whole Jesus, now I say that, pardon me, blasphemy, is I'm going to be struck down. So, yeah. well, I thought, you know, if this is the thought that I base my entire life on, my entire worldview, my entire faith is based on this thought, and it's just this sort of wispy, ephemeral, non-substantial thing. Well, then, you know, that I can't really hold on to or grab or detain or keep with me, then what am I going to base my life on? And yeah. I guess a question I'm still working with, actually. But it did come back to this idea of basing my relationship with God or my relationship with life on the heart, basically, more than on the mind. And it was really, in a lot of ways, my entry into mysticism, into this world of connecting with things beyond words, in some place beyond words. So I did my first 10-day silent retreat, silent Vipassana retreat, in November of 2000. Then I did another one a few years later. And then I did, in the fall of 2005, I did a 3-month retreat that I'm still really riding in the wake of. It was such a powerful experience. Certain times during those retreats, my mind grew really, really calm and quiet, so that there was very little separation from me and nature, and me and what was going on outside. In these moments in the sort of temple in Massachusetts at IMS, winter had come on and there were these really strong winds blowing outside. And my mind had grown pretty quiet at that point, so there's really nothing going on in there. It was just the wind, really. It was just me and the wind. And everything just felt so okay and so fine, so complete in moments like that, that I think that's where I really started to have my answer to my earlier questions about faith. And I just felt that I didn't need to answer those questions conceptually. I didn't need to answer those questions in words anymore. Because in those moments of silence and connectedness, all the questions were answered. So a few years ago, sometime after the first silent retreat, I had that nightmare again, where I was falling through space. But this time, it wasn't a nightmare. It turned into a really peaceful, beautiful dream. And I was still falling. None of the context of the dream, none of the images of the dream had changed at all. But my feeling about it, my relationship to it, had totally changed somehow. And I was okay with the falling. It was actually really beautiful to be out there falling somehow. And I didn't feel alone anymore either. Didn't feel alone anymore. And I wasn't concerned that I'd never find a place to land. Somehow that was okay too. I just felt safe somehow. So this is the kind of peace that the Dharma has given me. And the thing I find really amazing about it and fascinating about it still is that instead of replacing one set of concepts or one set of beliefs with another, most fundamentally what it's done is it's helped me find sort of okayness with the unanswered questions. Because there's always unanswered questions, really, in our lives. So it helped me find ground in the groundlessness, I think is what I want to say. So may you all find ground in the groundlessness. Thank you. So free to ask any questions.
Thank you for the talk. Sure. And I'm wondering if you could clarify a little bit what aspects of your Vipassana practice support you in what must be your very stressful work, the paid and non-paid.
I think what I end up doing a lot is holding for the clients holding for them a sort of hope, holding them, holding for them a sort of feeling that it's going to be okay, that they can't hold for themselves in that moment. You know, the emotions get so intense for them that it's really all they can see. And somehow, because I've been there in that swirling chaos of emotion and sort of found a way to breathe through it, you know, like I was just doing in preparation or before the talk, you know, my heart was racing and stuff, but I just told myself, oh, you can just breathe. You know, that's all the meditation practice is. So it's like, oh, cool, I can do that. I can breathe. So that's what I do. Yeah.
What's your relationship with Jesus like now?
Yeah, I still talk to Jesus all the time and still have a lot of respect for who Jesus was. You know, I don't really feel the need for the Savior sort of thing, for that whole idea. Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, there's so many pieces to that. I guess I'll just say one piece, which is that I feel like I'm seeing Jesus as a sort of role model, like. He walked a path that I can walk to, and that's kind of, in some ways, heretical in the tradition I grew up in, which is kind of like evangelical Christianity, kind of verging towards like Calvinism, which is sort of like that everything you do, God does for you. You can't do anything for yourself. And so, what I'm doing is really I'm owning my. Karma, owning my stuff and saying that I've got to do this work. I've got to walk this path. And Jesus can illustrate some ways to do that. And in that way, actually, I feel very close to Jesus. I feel this huge respect for him. I guess the last thing I'll say about that is watching the Passion for Christ and what was it called? The Mel Gibson one? The Passion of the Christ, is that what he called it? Yeah, all right. So you know, so Jesus is up on the cross and forgiving the people who are who had crucified him. That really, really struck me when I saw that, because just how difficult that would be. You know, and if you just view Jesus as God, it's like, well, of course God can forgive like that because God is God. But if you view Jesus as more like a man who learned how to be that compassionate, that's like, wow, that's phenomenal how to be that compassionate. And the meditation starts to let me feel like that sort of space is possible for me to be into, that level of compassion and forgiveness. Is possible, because what the meditation does is it allows you to hold, you know, a huge intensity of feeling, and somehow have some balance and equilibrium with it. And I think that's what Jesus was probably able to do in that moment. Oh, thanks. Yeah.
I'm wondering if your feeling of falling and being okay with that falling is the same kind of fear, I guess, that I have of infinity. It's like, I don't understand it. No one can explain it. Maybe you can. I haven't run across anyone that can. And it's kind of not okay with me because I'll get very passionate. How can something go on and on and on just... I guess it's got something to do with my fear of death or what really happens. Mm-hmm. So do you think that's the same as your fear of falling?
Yeah, yeah. I think you hit on it when you said the fear of death. I think they're very, very similar, similar fears. Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to answer that question. This one might not be satisfactory, but... you can email me later and maybe I'll have another idea. But when there's this old teaching of dependent arising, or right, codependent arising, codependent origination, which really looks at sort of like karmically how our likes and dislikes arise, how our attachments to things arise in any moment. And there's like thousands and thousands of these mind moments a second, they say, or something like that. You know, if you really, really focus down on it. And every one of those moments is a moment of letting go in some way. And every one of those moments, I think, is a sort of death. Some sort of small death of letting go. So this thing of probably, of even in the moment of death, is not like one thing of letting go to life. It's letting go to a lot of things. You know, it's letting go to your family. It's letting go to your, you know, your love of taking walks out in nature. It's a lot of letting go moments. It's just sort of heightened, I think, in that moment of death. But we can practice for that moment all the time by just letting go, by saying it's okay that, like, this situation didn't turn out the way I wanted it to, you know. You know, it's like, for, you know, I'm in a rush to get to work, and now the line at the gas station is really long. What a pain in the ass, you know. And letting go of that, that sort of anger or upsetness at that moment is sort of letting go. I think it's the exact same thing as in the moment of death, and in dealing with that thing of the fact that we want everything to last forever, including our lives. So meditation helps us practice that.
What do you tell your Christian friends?
I don't talk about it, to be honest. I just still don't. This sort of, you know, talk that I give tonight would probably be just like so far out, such total gibberish to the people I grew up with that, like, I just don't even go there because they'd just be so worried for me and feel that I'm so lost and confused and stuff like that. But I really rather not be seen in that light, I guess, most of the time. And I don't really like the idea that people are praying for me. It seems kind of condescending. So, you know, I should be praying for them or something, I guess. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't really talk about it. Like my sister married a pretty intense Christian guy who's becoming a pastor, and he's actually getting ordained in a few weeks. And my mom's visiting them right now, and so my mom's all excited for me giving this talk, but I'm kind of like, you know, don't mention it to Jenny, because, you know, they'll worry about me and they'll have an all-night prayer vigil for me or something like that. Maybe one day. I actually, my hope and prayer actually is that I can one day sort of translate my Dharma experience into Christian terminology well enough that I can legitimize it in some way. I feel the need to do that. Yeah, I hope the need to do that passes. Yeah, you're right.
You'll let it go.
You're right. I hope I let it go. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But I think it would actually be rather useful in some ways to help kind of, I don't know, like, I'm not saying I'm Thomas Merton or anything like that, but like the work that Thomas Merton was doing to kind of connect Christians and Buddhists, I think, was really beautiful. And so one of my dreams would be to hold a meditation retreat with Christians and Buddhists, especially the evangelical Christians, you know. That would be pretty cool.
It would be enjoyable to see them sit for, let's say, 7 days.
I doubt they could do it. But
there are Christian
there are.
Yeah.
But this evangelical Christian tradition is just so, it's just so specific about the way things should be and what the beliefs are, you know, that it's just not, there's not much room for that. You know, my sister thinks that her main objection to my going on this 3-month retreat was that sitting in silence was just a big opportunity for the devil to come in and talk to me. Because, what's that? Yeah, you can't think for yourself, you know. Or God couldn't speak to you. God, I mean, you know, it maddens me so much that this idea that God can't speak to people anymore. You know, God only spoke to people like 2,000 years ago and then he just stopped talking, you know. And only the devil talks to you now, you know. So, or that, you know, God only talks to you through the Bible. I think that's possible, but there's a lot of other ways that God talks. And my experience is at the retreat when I was like, you know, it was winter and I walked down to the lake and the lake's frozen and the wind's blowing the snow off of the lake, you know, into these like wisps of snow. It was, I mean, that's God talking to me right there, as far as I'm concerned. One other thing I'll say is like, thing with like, you know, your thoughts. I had this, I think I was like going crazy or something for a little while because I was, you know, feeling like there was this battle in my mind all the time between God and Satan. And there was this one book that was going around that was really popular for a while called This Present Darkness. And there was another one, Piercing the Darkness. And there was this idea that there are angels and demons literally right now fighting over our souls, you know, even in this very room, you know. And they're really going at it right now because now there's this Christian giving a Dharma talk. And, you know, the demons are probably blocking the door right now so the angels can't get in or something like that. You know? Anyway. I was just going crazy trying to like figure out, oh my God, is this God talking to me right now or is it Satan talking to me? And I just had to, say, you know, screw all this. The thoughts that happen in my head are my thoughts. They're my thoughts. And I'm going to deal with them on that level. And that was, I think, psychologically speaking, was a really good choice to make that declaration. Yeah. Yes.
This is actually an open question because I forget there somewhere in the canon there's Buddha said there's things to give up. There's belief in the supernatural, the clinging to ideas. Can anybody help me out on this? There's a series of things in a way you let go of and you sort of move away the clutter. In order to really kind of get in touch with the dharmas as far as what that has to offer and the teachings there. Mm-hmm. It seems that with Judeo-Christian belief, it's one really has to cling to certain beliefs or else the edifice kind of doesn't work.
Yeah.
Kind of falls down.
Yeah.
So I know there's probably no missionary like a convert, but you sort of have to let a horse come to the well of Dharma, but you cannot make him drink, type of a thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. I guess in this, you know, this talk, I was trying to sort of narrate my all these different thoughts that this thought that connected to that thought that got me here, you know, so this, you know, I mean, that decision that I made to connect with God through the heart rather than through the mind was a pretty critical one. And I thought that I could maintain a solid Christian faith with that idea. But then the thing is, you know, the less important concepts and thoughts get, the less necessary they become. And then, like, all of a sudden, you're not really being an evangelical Christian anymore, because it's all about the thoughts, really. It's all about the concepts. It's all about reiterating these basic beliefs that, you know, Jesus died on the cross for your sins. You know, you rose 3 days later, and only through a relationship with Him can you know God in eternal life. And, like, that's... Oh, I suspect it has something to do with control, but maintaining hierarchy and stuff like that. That's...
It was questioning the. It seems to be a principal dogma in the Christian faith of the aspect of Jesus dying for one's sins. I never understood the dying and the resurrection part as a central component to the teachings that he gave, which were had really nothing to do with portion that I could see.
Yeah, well, that's really, you know, Paul's contribution, St. Paul, with, you know, all those letters. I mean, a lot of the Christianity I grew up in was in some ways more based on the teachings of Paul than on the teachings of Christ. And Paul was the one that, you know, in my mind, the one who really created this idea of who Jesus is to us. More than Jesus did, in my opinion.
It seems that if you look at like Elaine Pagel's Gnostic Gospels, I don't know if you got a chance to go through that. It seemed like it was a power play back in 200 AD, the Orthodox, the Gnostics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, right there again is sort of the bifurcation between the mystic tradition and I don't know what the other side would be called, but.
The Orthodox
tradition, yeah. So that's still, you know, the same thing is still present today. And I guess, you know, I sort of found myself going down the mystic path. And unfortunately, right now, there's not a lot of... there is Christian mystic tradition, like you were saying. I think that needs to be reawakened as well. Yeah. I don't know. There's so much more to say, but... Thanks for your questions. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
In your brand of Christianity, do you see prayers? Praying being similar to some of the things in Buddhism?
Oh, like a mantra type? Kind of.
Well, I grew up sort of a Gothic Roman Catholic.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I really see a parallel between the Metta Sutta and the prayer of St. Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Mm-hmm. Where there's ignorance, pardon, death, faith, despair, hope. Mm-hmm. And I really see a lot of similarities between that prayer and some of the more active Buddhist, the medicine.
Yeah, totally. No, there's not a lot of those prayers in my tradition. It's pretty much you just shoot from the hip. pray as the Spirit leads you, kind of thing. But then again, you know, St. Francis is cool. He's kind of more on the mystic side of things, so definitely can connect that with Buddhism more. And I think if we're going to have any sort of interreligious dialogue or any sort of peace between, you know, Christianity and other religions, it's going to have to be through the mystic traditions, you know, because it's more open to connecting with where sinking beneath the concepts and connecting with sort of the heart of of God and what's going on there. You know, because in that realm, we're all the same. We're all united, I think. It's just when you get into the head stuff that there's a lot of different ways of describing it. But I feel like describing it, you know, that's not where the heart is, you know. Sort of going back to what your question about the things to let go of. I mean, even in the Buddhist tradition, ultimately you're supposed to let go of the Dharma itself, you know, because any time that you step back from the pure presence of being to describe it or to put any words on it, you've left it in that moment. You create. Yeah, exactly. So even the Dharma, which is a way of describing what's going on in the meditation practice, is not the meditation practice itself. You know, and it's very useful, and we all need it. But ultimately, it's that moment of enlightenment, the Dharma won't even be necessary anymore. Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like I'm just going to try to hang out with Jesus and talk to him and stuff like that. And, you know, all those concepts and stuff, just I don't need to worry about so much anymore. But maybe that's just my pride or conceit or something. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your sharing. It's funny because the religion, what you came from, they always talk about this Prince of Peace and all of the peace, what they have. And it seems that they are quite tormented with their concern because you're going to hell and you're going to be tortured forever. I mean, according to their beliefs. But I see you as having so much peace, not concerned about all of those things. And how do you feel towards their plight of living this life with so much torment while still crying that they have peace?
I don't know. Again, I just think there's a lot of fear. You know, it's a pretty basic human sort of condition to be afraid of, especially afraid of death. Afraid of eternity, or that concept. So, I think that's what really drives people to have this very, very specific sort of explanation for where they're going to go after death. And, it's got sort of pros and cons to it, that kind of concept, because, like, some people are going to go to heaven and some people are going to go to hell. And luckily for them, as far as the Christians are concerned, they're the ones that are going to heaven. But I found it increasingly sort of unconscionable to think that God would allow people to go to hell. And a lot of people would say, well, you know, it's not God's not sending them there. They're choosing to reject God. So they're going there, you know, themselves. They're doing it to themselves. You know, God's not doing this to them. But in my mind, I just can't accept that, because it's like, well, if God created the whole play, then He created that the hell piece too in some way, or contributed to it, you know. So I think in some ways you've got to, like, I think what Christians end up doing is ignoring those sticky questions as much as possible, and just sort of defaulting back to, well, God knows best. You know, God knows what's going on. And, we can't explain it, but God knows. And, you know, we're going to be good, humble, faithful servants of the Lord, and we're just going to trust that God knows what He's doing. And, you know, that's just where I don't know. I can't just do that anymore. I just can't. I can't. I feel like God gave me a mind and a heart, a mind to think with and analyze with and all that, and a heart to feel with, and my mind objects to some of these concepts, you know, that God would be like this and allow people to go to hell. And my heart feels like God is more compassionate than that, so I can't accept it on that level either. And so I just tell God that. It's like, you know, this is what I started to do back then. I'm like, you know, God, I'm having a real hard time believing this, and I guess I'm still doing that. I don't know. I feel like, I don't know. At least I'm being honest. If God's still watching and still like judging me on those levels, all I'm doing is being honest with Him that, well, I don't really believe in all that right now, you know. But sorry, God, I don't really buy the whole Christian story right now. But you know, but I love you anyway. That's what I say. That's enough out of me. So thank you all very much for being here. Thanks. Why don't we just sit? You're not off the hook yet. So why don't we just sit for another 5 minutes. So whatever positive energy has been generated through this time together, we freely offer it to all living beings. May all beings be free from suffering.